Welcome to When They Popped. Let's rewind to a simpler time together and dive deep into the music, movement, and mania behind our favorite Y2K celebrities and trends. Hosted by Kelsey and Mary, it's time for another episode of When They Popped.
Hello, and welcome to When They Popped. I'm Kelsey.
And I'm Mary.
Mary, we're officially in mid-December. Are you done with your Christmas shopping yet?
Almost. Your BSB Y2K-ish themed gift should ship next week, but who knows with the damn mail.
Well, your gift is coming the day after tomorrow. It wouldn't let me send a gift message, so you'll know.
Like,
you'll
I wonder if we got each other the same thing.
Probably.
I think we got each other because I could put a gift message with yours, but I don't want
to. Amazon.com.
Oh, wait, no. Okay. No, you're going to die. Okay.
I cannot.
All right.
Okay. So now that that's out of the way and the suspense and tension is building, we have some Y2K news for you to know before we get into our episode today, which is all about our favorite Y2K holiday movies. But first, some piping hot news. Really, the only thing that I want to talk about is Amanda Bynes debuted her new podcast this week. I listened. Let's talk about it. So here's the thing. I support Amanda. I love the girl. If you've listened to our Amanda Bynes episode, you know, like, no one is a bigger fan than me. Like, I love her. So that's disclaimer number one. Disclaimer number two, I'm not like a podcast genius. Anyone who listens to this knows that, like, we're still learning, you know, we're like getting our feet wet in the podcasting world. I am by no means the authority on what it takes to have a good podcast. However, I will say I was a little confused because they never described like what the podcast is about. They just sort of kicked it off and it was like, hi, I'm Amanda and this is Paul. And we're interviewing this tattoo artist. And then Amanda was like, okay, are you ready for the questions? And she's like, so what do you do? And how did you get into it? And it just like immediately like started with this like tattoo person. I'm like, why do we care about the tattoo person? Who's Paul? Like, what's going on? What I did really like about it though, is they have video. So you can watch it. And Amanda looks great. She has super platinum blonde hair now. She seemed a little nervous in the beginning, which who wouldn't be? So I'm just happy to see that she's doing well and she's doing something different. I guess I just wish there was more of like a, what is this podcast about? Like, what should we expect from you guys? But yeah, I just was a little perplexed. Like, I don't know what to expect next, which I guess is exciting. You know, it's like a little gift every week. We won't know what we're going to unwrap. And maybe that's part of the fun of it.
Something I learned today about this that I had a different expectation was that the Paul that she has on isn't her ex-fiance Paul. So I thought it was her and her partner or ex. I'm not quite sure of their relationship status because his name is also Paul.
She mentioned ex-Paul as her ex-fiance. So clearly she wants us to know that he is a former fiance, not current. So yeah, I don't know who this Paul guy is. I looked him up on Instagram and he only has like 800 followers. Amanda described him on her Instagram. He's like a biochemist or something. He's like a genius. Yeah. I was like, oh, is this going to be like sciencey? But I didn't really get that from it. So who's to say? We're in for a surprise. They said we'll have another episode next week. So I'm still going to tune in. I hope I didn't discourage any of you guys from listening. I just don't want you to go in thinking that you're going to get any explanation about what
this is.
But it was still, she seems really well. And that makes me so happy. So I think what I had like 18 disclaimers in that Y2K news for you to know. Well, here's one more that we do not own or claim to own the rights to the songs or performances in this episode. Because the purpose of these clips is just for commentary and critique. You know, just two gals critiquing.
Well, I'm about to critique the hell out of a Christmas classic, but not critique because I love it so much. Is critique negative?
No, I don't think critique is negative. I think criticism is negative.
Okay. Yeah.
So but critique is feedback.
And there's going to be a lot of positive feedback, at least for me. I wanted to start off with Home Alone 1 and Home Alone 2.
Kevin!
I swear, as soon as Halloween rolls around, I am like itching to watch these movies. Gets like a switch is flipped. I don't know what it is. As soon as the air gets a little crisper, a crisp 60 70 degrees in Florida.
Does it get in Florida?
These Home Alone movies are just such a feel-good, warm blanket for me. So comforting, so light. And guess what's crazy? I did not grow up watching Home Alone. I was not a huge movie person back in the day, and I've only been watching them like the last 5 years or so after my boyfriend introduced them to me.
What?
But like now I can't imagine my life without them. Right?
You've only had Home Alone in your life for the last five years?
Yes. Literally 2018, 2019. Yes.
So the first time I saw Home Alone, I think I was like Kevin's age, where like I thought that I could wish my family to go away and like it might happen. And I also thought that they might leave me behind on a trip. So it became like my biggest fear that my parents were going to leave me home alone accidentally. And like, I'd have to fight off like home invaders.
Oh, that would have stressed me out too as a kid.
It was stressful.
Yes.
This movie was fucking stressful. And there's a tarantula and a radiator that's scary. Like these are all very real fears when you're like, what? He's supposed to be like, what, seven?
Yeah. But the contraptions in this movie, this would have been like my bread and butter. I loved like little inventions. I just loved how he got to like make these incredible inventions in these movies. And
inventions, Mary, he was fighting off two men who wanted to kill.
Yes, but there were all these like different like little contraptions and machines. Oh, I wish I could have done
that. You're putting a positive spin on it. I like that you're coming from a place of positivity. Meanwhile, all I was ever thinking when I was a little kid after seeing this was, how can I make this house a fortress so no one can come in? And like when he had the cardboard cutouts pretending like to have like a holiday party. So my mom had some cardboard cutouts of like Billy Joel and one of like Al Gore or something. I was like, maybe if I put these guys in front of the window, like
that you already
people
had
won't
some.
Think I'm home alone. Yeah, like I literally would like think of this movie when I'd be home alone and scared. I'd be like, okay, how do I like Kevin McAllister the fuck out of this?
Well, it's just interesting because like we have two different perspectives. Like I discovered this movie as an adult, so I wouldn't, you know, have those anxieties. But watching it as a kid, like I would completely understand why you felt how you felt and why you might have those feelings still reminisce.
LOL.
But quick plot refresher. 8-year-old Kevin McAllister acts out the night before a family trip to Paris. And his mom, Moira Rose, makes him sleep in the attic, leading Kevin to wish he never had to see his family ever again. So the McAllisters, they sleep through their alarm as per usual, and they leave for the airport without Kevin. He wakes up to an empty house and assumes, oh my God, his wish to not have his family anymore has come true. But it's not all fun and games. It turns sour quick when he realizes that two con men plan to rob the McAllister residence, and he alone must protect the family home. Bum, bum, bum. So you know a movie like this has got to have some exciting, fun backstory. It's got an incredible cast. It's a classic. So the writer and producer, John Hughes, conceived Home Alone while preparing to go on vacation himself. He said, quote, I was going away on vacation and making a list of everything I didn't want to forget. I thought, well, I better not forget my kids. Then I thought, what if I left my 10-year-old son at home? What would he do? End quote. The rest is history. John Hughes wrote 8 pages of notes right then and there that eventually developed into the screenplay. And notably, John Hughes is the man behind other faves and classics like Ferris Bueller, The Breakfast Club, 16 Candles, Trains, Planes, and Automobiles, just to name a few. So you know a project with his name attached to it is going to be legit. Like he was a big deal. So Home Alone was supposed to be a Warner Brothers film. And John Hughes promised Warner Brothers that he could make the movie for less than $10 million, which was considerably less than most feature films' budgets were back in the day. He was worried, though. John Hughes was worried that the film might exceed that amount. He kind of maybe undershot it a little bit. So he met secretly with 20th Century Fox on the DL before production to see if they would fund the project if Warner Brothers proved inflexible if the budget started to creep past $10 million. According to executive producer Scott Rosenfeld, a copy of the script was quote-unquote clandestinely delivered to Fox, bypassing the legal restrictions that would have otherwise prevented Fox from seeing it. Early in the production, the budget did indeed grow to $14.7 million, and Warner Brothers was proving to be inflexible and demanded that it be cut by $1.2 million. And the producers, they were going back and forth with the studio. They're like, we cannot make it any cheaper than what we're doing. So Warner Brothers shut down the production the very next day. But do not worry. We have this classic because Fox took up John Hughes on his offer and took over production of the movie. The final budget did indeed grow to $18 million, so a bit over that $10 million that was expected. But thank goodness for Fox. I'm sure Warner Brothers is kicking itself over that. My God. So next, John asked Chris Columbus. Yes, that is his name. Not the Chris Columbus, but he asked.
Can you imagine?
It is crazy, but John asked Chris Columbus to direct. So I mentioned a star-studded cast. This movie obviously has one. And it was John Hughes that suggested to Chris Columbus that they cast Macaulay Culkin as Kevin because John worked with Macaulay while shooting Uncle Buck, a movie I've never seen. But Chris was like, okay, I'm interested, but I'm still going to do my due diligence as a director. And so he met with 200 other actors for the part because he felt it was his directorial responsibility. John Mulaney was asked to audition for the role of Kevin after being scouted in a children's sketch comedy group, but his parents said, no, refused the opportunity. And then Chris finally, at the end, he finally met with Macaulay and agreed he was the right choice. Macaulay's little brother, Kieran, Succession, hello, also plays, I believe, his younger cousin in the first two Home Alones. And it's really cute to see them both on screen together.
Oh my God, is he the one with the glasses?
Yeah, that pees the bed.
Oh my God, I didn't realize that was
you didn't?
Wait, that's so cute.
And obviously we get Catherine O'Hara playing Kevin's mom. She's like such an acclaimed actress, but I feel like a lot of our generation doesn't really know her besides Schitt's Creek. She's in a lot. She's quite a get. And it was so nice to see her and Macaulay at the Hollywood Walk of Fame ceremony just a few weeks ago. She was there. Love seeing that moment between them. But after Robert De Niro and John Lovitz turned down the role of criminal Harry, Joe Pesci accepted it. We get some interesting stories about Joe Pesci, who was honestly probably the biggest name in the film. A cinematographer recalled that Joe Pesci was more difficult to work with than Macaulay Culkin, which, you know, you would expect maybe the child actor would be a bit more difficult, but no. Apparently, Joe believed that some of the dialogue was not of quality to measure it with his acting ability. He had been in some big roles by this time. He also resented the early call times for when he had to be on set because they prevented him from starting his day with 9 holes of golf. Apparently, after he took the assistant director by the collar one day to complain about these early start times, daily call times were moved back from 7 to 9 a.m. to accommodate him playing golf in the morning.
And yet women are too emotional.
I know.
Like, what?
But I digress. Joe said in a 2022 interview with People in regards to working with Macaulay, quote, "I intentionally limited my interactions with him to preserve the dynamic." He didn't want Macaulay to become too comfortable with him. He did that, in, you know, to maintain the integrity of the adversarial relationship between the characters. And I get that. That makes sense.
Oh my God, when he said that he was going to bite his fingers off.
Oh, that was a whole thing because during one of the rehearsals for that scene, Joe actually like bit his finger more than he was supposed to. And Macaulay has a scar on his finger from that rehearsal scene.
From Joe Pesci?
Yes.
Biting him?
Yes.
Oh my God.
Another iconic but brief appearance in this movie, we get the late, great John Candy. And he was only available for one day to film his scenes, which took in total 23 hours to shoot. So basically the whole day. He was only paid $414 for his contributions since he basically did the film as a favor to an old friend of his, John Hughes. And in return, he was the only actor that John allowed to go off script. And according to Chris, all of John Candy's dialogue in that movie is completely improvised. And to me, that's insane. And it also shows off the acting chops of Catherine O'Hara because she was the one who was basically on the screen with him for the majority of his scenes. And since he's improvising, seemingly she would have to improvise all her lines as well, which is crazy.
Oh, my favorite scenes are the John Candy scene. I mean, the polka band. John Candy just seems so genuinely warm.
Yes.
Oh, I just love it so much. Like, it makes me want to ride in a polka truck.
Oh, I know. He had such a sweet, endearing energy in this movie and was such a great addition. There were some stunts in this movie, and they created some tension for the crew during shooting. Director Chris Columbus said that every time the stunt guys did one of those stunts, it was not funny. We'd watch it, and I would just pray that those guys were alive. So I'm assuming they're talking about all those crazy scenes when Kevin, like, is kicking the guys from the roof. They're falling down the stairs. They have cement land on them. When reading that, I realized how crazy the stunt work was. Like, though, some of those scenes are even hard to watch. They get their, like, asses kicked over and over.
Fire, like the torch.
Oh, yeah. The torch, that actually gave Joe Pesci, like, serious burns when his head was on fire. Like,
holy shit.
You know, this was actually a pretty dangerous movie, it sounds like.
The one I always think of is the nail on the basement stairs.
Oh, my God.
I have nightmares about that one.
Oh, my God. It's almost, like, hard to watch because it's just, like...
It is. Boom, I'm like, boom. Can we go back to the ice cream scene?
Yes, please. Did you know this film was scored? Because I sure as hell didn't. Director Chris Columbus, he initially hoped to have Bruce Broughton score the film. However, Bruce was busy with The Rescuers Down Under and he had to cancel at the last minute. I loved that Disney movie. It's so cute. It's about these like little mice that are like heroes and they're so freaking
cute. I am obsessed with The Rescuers Down Under. Yes.
Oh, Aria. Like, I know all the songs. Don't worry.
Oh my God, that scary lady with the red hair.
Yes, and her crocodiles.
And Bianca is so pop.
Oh, Bianca and Bernard.
Yes. Okay, we need to do an episode on The Rescuers.
I love it. So they were kind of bummed they couldn't get this guy to score the film, but Christopher Columbus got in touch with Steven Spielberg, who helped him contact John Williams to produce the final score. Williams is a casual individual who has won the likes of 25 Grammy Awards, 5 Academy Awards, and 4 Golden Globe Awards. He's known for the music behind Star Wars. Indiana Jones. Jurassic Park. Literally just to skim the surface, if any movie has like a compelling theme song with violins, it's likely John Williams.
Like all the ones you recognize.
Yes, like a recognizable theme. So that's pretty cool. But Home Alone premiered in November of 1990. Kelsey and I weren't even born yet. It's crazy how long this movie's been around. It grossed $285 million in the United States and a worldwide total of $476.7 million. It was the number one film at the box office for 12 consecutive weeks. It was the highest grossing film of 1990. It earned a Guinness World Record as the highest grossing live action comedy ever domestically, and it held that title for 27 years until Never Say Die knocked it out of the top spot in 2017. Literally, I have no idea what that is. Yeah. Who knows? I can't imagine it's better than Home Alone, but Macaulay won Best Young Actor at the Youth in Film Awards. Home Alone itself was nominated for 2 Academy Awards, one for Best Original Score by John Williams, and Original Song, also by John Williams, but did not win. Macaulay and the movie were also nominated at the Golden Globes, but again, lost. But the success of this movie is undeniable. I have some favorite parts. We obviously get that very iconic, "Merry Christmas, you filthy animal."
Merry Christmas, you filthy animal.
I literally didn't know what that was till 5 years ago. Like, I'd hear people say it, and I'd be like, ha ha ha. Had no idea that that was from Home Alone.
Mary.
But I know. It's crazy. I was under a rock. But like, as I mentioned earlier, the extent Kevin goes to protect his house, like all these like traps he sets, I would have thought that was so cool as a kid. But it's so cute. Like, he's so scared when the robbers first come that he hides under his parents' bed. And then he decides, he's like, I'm the man of the house and I'm not scared anymore.
This is ridiculous. Only a wimp would be hiding under a bed. I can't be a wimp. I'm the man of the house.
Hey! I'm not afraid anymore!
It's just so precious. He's like a baby and he's like trying to be the man of the house. I just want to give him a hug. But just the creativity is a 10 out of 10, a kid's dream, honestly, at least for me. And then the side plot with old man Marley just always touches my heartstrings.
Me too. When he talks about his granddaughter.
I know. But what about any favorite parts that I missed?
Oh, Buzz's girlfriend. Woof. That line is just...
That's something I need to mention. That picture that they show of Buzz's girlfriend. So they didn't want to actually make fun of a girl for that. Like, they just felt like it would be wrong. And so the crew member's son volunteered to be made to look like a girl and be Buzz's girlfriend in the picture.
I love that. That's like before AI could like make a fake.
Yes.
What are my other parts? I really love that part. Like the tarantula part. I just think it's very endearing when he faces all of his fears.
Yes.
I also think Marv is just kind of funny. Like, I know he's a bad guy, but I don't know. I liked him more than Joe Pesci's character for sure.
See, I enjoyed Joe Pesci's character as an adult because, you know, how I know Joe Pesci is Casino, is Goodfellas, all the gangster movies. I just love that he took a role like this and really flipped the switch, as Drake says.
I just flipped the switch.
I also love that the parents sit in first class and make the kids sit in steerage. And every year, the meme makes its way around, like, what did Kevin's dad do to afford that beautiful home?
Oh, my God, that house. I love that house in Winnetka. So I have family in Winnetka, and it is, like, a nice-ass area, let me tell you. I don't know what Kevin's dad was doing with all his freaking kids. And in the next movie, he has just, like, wads of money that...
I love when he's like, that's it. I forgot to close the garage.
That's it. I forgot to close the garage. That's it.
I think about him sometimes because who doesn't have that panic spiral? Like, did I leave that curling iron on? Did I leave the candle lit? And I think of the dad and I'm like, you know, that was it. I left the garage. I don't even have a garage, but I just think it's funny.
Yeah, there's just a lot of gems interspersed throughout this movie. And this movie exploded. Unsurprisingly, a sequel was quickly in the works. In February of 1991, John Hughes signed a 6-picture deal with 20th Century Fox, and among the 6 projects was a sequel to Home Alone, aka Home Alone Lost in New York. Now, I like Home Alone 2 just as much, if not more, than the first Home Alone. And what do we always say? A sequel is successful when the core main cast returns, and that's exactly what happened here. Everybody came back. Macaulay was paid $4.5 million plus 5% of the film's gross to appear in the sequel, compared to the $110,000 he got for his leading role in the original. The sequel received a $28 million budget, nearly $10 million more than the original. Now, in this one, instead of being home alone in Winnetka, in this version, Kevin is home alone, away alone, whatever you want to call it, in New York.
Away alone. I like that.
Alone and away.
Vacationing alone.
Literally a 9-year-old vacationing alone in a suite at the Plaza Hotel. Living the freaking dream, baby. Otherwise, this movie has like a very similar plot. Kevin, he gets to the airport this time. They make sure they get Kevin to the airport, but he loses track of his father at the airport while they're all headed on a family vacation to Miami. And Kevin follows the wrong person. He gets on a plane headed for New York City. This is when you could just like get on a plane, you know, like now you can't like get on a plane without your ticket being scanned. And like, there would be no way for this to happen today. So Kevin goes to wonderful New York and he cons his way into a room at the Plaza Hotel and the usual antics begin. But when Kevin discovers that the sticky bandits from the first Home Alone, so Joe Pesci and Marv, they're back on the streets on the loose in New York, and Kevin puts up a fight to stop them from robbing an elderly man's toy store just before Christmas. Director Chris Columbus also returned for the sequel. In addition, we get icon and legend John Williams back yet again to score the film. The stars are aligned for an incredibly successful sequel. The movie came out in December of 1992, just 2 years after the original, and it's rare that a sequel will do better than an original, but it did pretty damn well and better than most sequels, in my opinion. It had a worldwide gross of $359 million. Compared to the $476 million of the first film, you know, it's not as good, but like, again, this is a sequel. I feel like that's really good. But for this one, I just loved seeing Kevin living the life at the plaza. He has his dad's credit cards. He has a big envelope full of cash that Mr. McAllister was just walking around with.
Like, this what was he planning to do in Miami?
No, literally, though. All the cash.
He was going
Miami.
To 11.
He was going out.
Go to 11.
Oh, my.
Set up the strip club.
Oh, my God. So funny. But, like, when I would threaten to run away as a kid, like, this is what I only dreamt I could do. Con my way.
The life you thought you'd live.
Yes. I'd find a way into the plaza and still have my dad's money. So
yeah. You're like, is this camping?
Kevin's getting room service. He's eating ice cream in bed. He's swimming at this lavish hotel pool, having a pizza in a limo as he goes to the toy store, like very F.A.O. Schwartz vibes. The nostalgia of it is just such a warm hug for me.
Just funny because like that could never happen today because everyone's credit card like alerts go right to their phone.
Yeah.
Like world could, I mean, not that it would happen in the first place, but it feels like such faraway times.
He like checked into the hotel as like a 9-year-old. Like
now parents are like tracking their kids and stuff.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Luggage would have like an Apple AirTag in it.
I know.
Like everyone would know where he was.
I truly think I'm so obsessed with it because it's so nostalgic, because he doesn't have all the technology. He's using like a tape recorder, but there have been 4 more Home Alones released since. So there's a total of 6. And the third one, John Hughes did write. We're actually in the middle of watching the third one. I do really like the third one, but none of these renditions have the original cast, and they definitely, I would say after 3, really kind of go downhill, in my opinion. But the most recent one just came out in 2021. It's crazy.
Oh, shit. I didn't even know that.
They're still trying to ride the coattails of this incredibly successful franchise, and I totally understand why.
Have they brought Kevin back as like a dad?
No, but they brought back Buzz.
Oh, God.
In this most recent one. But that's it. Then that's why, you know, they're not as good. It's probably because John Hughes is dead. So it's just not the same. You know, I don't know. But without that original crew, it's hard to recreate the magic. But that's my first. What do you got for us, Kel?
That was a great one, Mary. I also love Home Alone. Great rundown. So this movie that I picked is definitely for adults. It's not for children. It came out in 2005. And it is Just Friends. This movie makes me pee my pants every time I see it. It's become one of those modern Christmas classics for sure. It's so fucking funny. So here's a little rundown of the plot in case you forgot. And unlike me, you don't watch it every 4 months or so. So in 1995, Chris Brander, played by Ryan Reynolds, is an overweight high school senior, and he is secretly and madly in love with his best friend, Jamie Palomino, played by Amy Smart. In the early 2000s, I feel like she was the love interest in everything. She is so amazing. I think she played this role perfectly. So Chris is obsessed with Jamie, and he decides the time to tell her his real feelings for her is in her yearbook, because graduation is tomorrow. It's now or never. So he goes to her graduation party. And as he gives back Jamie's yearbook with all of his innermost tender thoughts and feelings, he accidentally swaps Jamie's yearbook with her ex-boyfriend, Tim, who's like this big jock football loser. And Tim reads Chris's sweet note to Jamie out loud to everyone. And it's really embarrassing to poor Chris. And Jamie doesn't make anything better because she kisses him on the cheek and she says the words no guy wants to hear after admitting that he's in love with his best friend. I love you like a brother.
Womp, womp.
I love you, Chris. Like a brother.
Womp womp is right, Mary. So poor Chris leaves the party in tears. He promises that he will be more successful than everyone else and that he's never going to see them again. Flash forward 10 years later, Chris gets hot and he is also a music executive. Somehow he's also a VP, which just sounds like a really fast tracked.
Yes.
10 years after high school, not college. Anyways, he's managing one of the hottest pop acts of the year. They're also like kind of hooking up with each other. Her name is Samantha James, played by Anna Faris. I mean, this role could not have been more perfect for her. She totally knocked it out of the park. Samantha James is obsessed with Chris. She basically like wants to wear his skin. So Anna may be talented, but she's not necessarily the brightest bulb. So when she puts her aluminum foil covered salmon in their private jet's microwave, the plane has to make an emergency landing in New Jersey. Fate would have it where Chris grew up. So the PJ is grounded. The weather is bad. He's stuck in New Jersey for the first time in 10 years. So he decides, oh, I'm with like the hottest pop act. I'm hot. We're both hot. Why don't I go home and show everyone how hot I am and my flashy new lifestyle and show them that I made good on my promise to be better than everyone else. In the process, he rediscovers his unresolved feelings for his old best friend, Jamie, and he basically tries to rub his new lifestyle in her and everybody else's faces. To be crass, like he really just wants to finally have sex with Jamie after all those years of being friend zoned. It was like kind of pathetic. It started out in the beginning. He just wants to like lay here and be like, haha, fuck you. Like I did it. I'm better than you. And no one is like rooting for Chris to win. It's like a weird ego trip for him. And then he really discovers that he does have these unresolved feelings for Jamie. And it is true love. And he misses his best friend. So Chris is doing anything he can to get out of the friend zone. He even goes on a day-day ice skating where he ends up injuring himself. Do you remember this scene?
This scene is one of the best in the movie. So funny.
I agree. It's like a mix of slapstick and like Ryan Reynolds just like biting sarcasm. That for me, I'm not usually a big fan of like the physical comedy, but I think they did a great job blending it all together. So Jamie is a teacher at the local elementary school. She runs into some of her students at the ice skating rink. Miss Palomino. They're so excited to see her. And they're like, oh, you and Chris need to join us in a little pickup hockey game. Well, the kids are just hilarious. They're relentlessly making fun of Chris. They're egging him on. One of my favorite lines that I say all too often out of context that doesn't make sense is when he's like, oh, I can't ice skate. Like, I have rentals. Like, these aren't my real skates.
Oh, yeah.
Like, and they're like, a good skater can skate in anything.
A good skater can skate in anything.
Such a good scene. Oh, my God.
So the plot thickens when Chris is like, fuck you, little kids. And he tries to do a slap shot and like basically ruin one of the kids' lives. Well, it ends up backfiring. He hits the pole of the goal and it ricochets and hits him in the mouth. What's worse than a high-speed puck to the face when you're trying to like impress your old high school crush? So they call for medical support.
It gets
He's
worse.
In, like, one of those toboggans. I mean, the toboggan scene is hilarious. Like when he falls over the toboggan. I mean, he's just totally incapacitated. The whole thing is hilarious. Fate would have it that he gets medical support from yet another high school classmate, Dusty Dinkelman, who was played by Chris Klein, who was also in love with Jamie in high school. So Dusty Dinkelman emerges as this heart of gold EMT who also happens to be a singer, songwriter, guitar player on the side. So now we have Chris sort of competing with Dusty for Jamie's affection. They're competing against one another. They end up going to the Notebook together inexplicably. Fun fact, Bradley Cooper was almost cast in the role of Dusty Dinkelman. Isn't that hilarious?
I would have liked that. That would have
I think Chris Klein was like perfect for it though, because he was so big in American Pie and he had this jock hot guy like reputation. So to see him as like a loser was kind of like interesting. Basically, this movie is just like a totally unhinged. It's just all unhinged until Chris, you know, realizes the error of his pursuit of Jamie. He ends up revealing he's always had feelings for her. He always will. And they kiss and they maybe end up happily ever after. Some of my favorite moments are just like the inexplicable moments in this movie. They're not necessarily Christmas themed. It just happens to take place during Christmas and Christmas lights end up exploding a house. So there's nothing super Christmassy about it. But what I loved were the unhinged performances and songwriting moments from Anna Faris as our psycho pop star. We get Forgiveness.
Saying sorry.
is more than saying sorry. I also love when they're at the mall and she is getting inspiration. Small people, they come and go. Small people, they just don't know.
Small people, they come and go. Small people, they just don't know.
We also get Chris and his brother just slapping the shit out of each other and then acting sweet with their mom. I feel like their mom was such a bright spot for me. Yes. She plays Viola's mom in She's the Man. I think she has some of the best lines in the movie. There's one scene where, you remember the whole kerfuffle when someone's on the house line?
The phone.
No one has a landline anymore. Well, Chris is on the phone with Jamie trying to hang out with her. And then his mom picks up the phone and she's like, Joyce? And Chris is like, I'm on the phone. And she's like, what are you doing at Joyce's house?
Now I'm the MVP in my league, in fact. Come on, be like old times.
Hello, Joyce?
Mom, I'm on the phone.
Well, Chris, what are you doing over at Joyce's?
No, Mom. I'm in the living room 10 feet away from you. And I'm on the phone.
Oh,
just those things that, like, us 90s kids, I feel like, will be the last generation to know what that was.
Yes.
Like. The other star of this movie is the song I Swear by All for One.
I swear, like the shadow that's by your side, I'll be there.
The opening scene of this movie, we get Chris lip syncing the song. And apparently that was all Ryan's idea. The director said that Ryan on the spot was like, I really think I should lip sync this. And they got it all in one shot. Mary, I need to know, what are your favorite memes of this movie?
I love Ryan Reynolds' humor. I really am a fan of the dry, self-deprecating humor. And so he is a bright spot. I found it interesting. I learned that Anna Faris was inspired by a Britney Spears type pop star. I don't know if you read that.
So the inspiration for Samantha was largely fueled by Paris Hilton. And Paris even auditioned for the part. And the director, his name is Robert Cumble. He said that they saw like a lot of people because it was such a fun part. Paris Hilton even came in and she was really good. But Paris was like sort of just starting to break into acting. And I think he was nervous that the movie would get attention for like the wrong reasons. But the way that they describe the Samantha James character is it's Lindsay and Paris and Brittany throw in some amphetamines, put them in a blender, and that's Samantha James. That was the direction that they gave to Anna Faris. And I feel like, I don't think that she did like any of those girls like justice by saying it was like influenced by Paris. Like, I don't think that's very nice or fair, but it was definitely influenced by the media conception of them. Like, it wasn't who they really are, but it was just who the media was like making them out to be. And I think she took it to like a very fun level.
She was like born for that role. She did such a great job.
Absolutely. Well, I have a couple of fun facts for you. So on the production side, the movie was filmed in Saskatchewan, which borders Alberta, Canada, and it gets cold AF there. And this wasn't like a production where they film it in July and they pretend to have fake snow and everyone's like secretly sweating under their parkas. Like, they didn't have a lot of budget for this movie, so they needed to go somewhere with an actual winter wonderland backdrop. They filmed it in the dead of winter. It gets to negative 40 degrees there. So Ryan has made like a lot of jokes. He's been on Conan O'Brien saying that, you know, it's so cold, you lose your childhood memories. But it was apparently so cold that planes couldn't even land there. So throughout filming, the production didn't get set visits from studio executives. So the crew on the ground was super tight knit. It seemed like they didn't have like Big Brother from the studio like looking over their shoulder, so they could really craft and workshop the movie how they wanted to. And I just love that sort of mental image of them all like going to Ryan's rental house after a day of filming and helping them shape the movie that they really wanted to. So there's this scene where Ryan's younger brother is supposed to be in charge of keeping Samantha busy. And instead, this is where she falls, like at the ball, and gets tased and stuff. So she comes home with this big, like Bugs Bunny type, like bandage around her head. Chris comes back and he's like, what is wrong with her? And she's just shoving toothpaste in her mouth.
Samantha, are you okay?
I'm a bubble.
Dude, she's fine. Look at her. She's having a good time. She's got her toothpaste.
So this scene was totally improvised on the spot. The toothpaste was not in the script because the director knew that if he wrote that in there, like, people would be like, no, that's not happening.
Yeah.
Like, we're not having her just like putting toothpaste in her mouth. But it totally ends up being one of the funniest parts of the movie. And this is where Samantha delivers that line of blueberry.
Blueberry.
It's just so, you have to watch it. If you don't know what I'm talking about, just put on the movie right now. So another fun behind the scenes tidbit, at the time of filming, Ryan was dating Alanis Morissette, which just always blows my mind that they date. And they were together for like a very long time, if I'm correct. And she visited the set and she made a cameo that didn't end up making the cut, but she is featured in the DVD deleted scenes, which is also on YouTube.
Oh, Chris Brander, I know who you are.
There we go.
Yeah, you slept with my assistant and never called her back. Nice to see you.
You too.
There's a cute little like video vlog, like day in the life that Ryan did leading up to the release of the movie, just like drum up some publicity around it. And she's featured in it. They were very sweet together, actually. So to wrap this up in a big Christmas bow, Ryan and Amy actually reunited earlier this year. Amy Smart, to star in an aviation gin commercial. Ryan owns the company. And it was supposed to be a take on Jamie and Chris like 18 years later in Happily Wedded Bliss. So I guess we get our ending to the movie right there, that they were meant to be together.
I didn't see that. That's amazing. Very cool. Oh, I love that movie, Kels. Thanks for refreshing my recollection with some of my favorite parts.
Oh my God. Anytime. Tell me what your next movie is.
Okay. My next one is How the Grinch Stole Christmas, a 2000 release, now Christmas classic, directed by Ron Howard and produced by Brian Grazer. The film was based on Dr. Seuss's 1957 children's book of the same name, and this was also the second adaptation of the book after the 1966 animated TV special, one of my all-time favorites. Did you grow up watching the cartoon, Kels?
Oh, I loved it. We would watch it like every Thanksgiving. Ugh. It was like our transition from fall to winter, Christmas time. I love the cartoon so much. I feel like I can recite it by memory at this point. The music, the way that his eyes curl, like the little tufts of hair curls. Little Cindy Lou Who. I love it all.
I loved it too. And I also learned that the Grinch in the original book was actually black and white instead of green with red eyes. And that sounds like terrifying. And the cartoon rendition was the first adaptation to make the Grinch green, which it makes sense. Grinch green, GG. We're not trying to like send kids into night terrors, right? We just want them to be like a little scary, not like a monster. But
also green is one of the main colors of Christmas,
right?
Like so it makes sense that he's like inherently green. Piece of Christmas. Like, yes. I don't know. I always thought that maybe he was like green with envy.
Right.
He was like jealous of everyone, really.
That makes sense to me. So someone got it right along the way. The story as to how this movie came into being is unsurprisingly super interesting. So before his death in 1991, the Dr. Seuss refused offers to sell the film rights to his books. But after his death, his widow, Audrey Geisel, she was starting to warm up to the idea. And in July of 98, Audrey Geisel's agents announced that she would auction the film rights of How the Grinch Stole Christmas. And to pitch their ideas, any potential movie suitors had to be willing to pay $5 million, 4% of the box office gross, 50% of the merchandising revenue and music-related material, and 70% of the income from book tie-ins. The announcement also stated that any actor submitted for The Grinch must be comparable in stature to Jack Nicholson, Jim Carrey, ding, 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 Robin Williams, and Dustin Hoffman. Additionally, the Seuss estate would not consider a director or writer who had not earned at least $1 million on a previous picture. So the standards were set pretty damn high. And so, of course, all the big guns came out. 20th Century Fox pitched its version with director Tom Shadack. He was behind Ace Ventura, Liar Liar, The Nutty Professor, Bruce Almighty, with Jack Nicholson on to play the Grinch. There was the Farley Brothers, who are behind There's Something About Mary, Dumb and Dumber. They had a pitch. And John Hughes, whose impressive credits I mentioned earlier, also pitched, and Universal Pictures had its presentation with Brian Grazer and Gary Ross in attendance. But Audrey Geisel, the widowed Mrs. Seuss, refused all these offers. But Brian Grazer was not deterred, and he enlisted his producing partner, Ron Howard to help with the negotiations. And at this point, Ron was not interested at all in this project, but agreed to help, you know, do his buddy a favor and help Brian pitch. He did not expect that they would get this. But while preparing, doing his due diligence, Ron became very interested in the character Cindy Lou Who and tailored the pitch accordingly with a film in which Cindy Lou Who would have a larger role and an expanded backstory for the Grinch. So Ron went from 0 to 100 real quick and just kind of dove into the intricacies of the Grinch story. And it was destiny. It was fate. And in 1998, Ron was signed to direct and co-produce the film with Jim Carrey in the lead role. Things started to come together. The script was complete after 8 drafts. Miss Geisel, the former Mrs. Seuss, had veto power over the script, and she utilized that veto power quite a few times in the process, apparently. Anything that was a little bit inappropriate, that type of thing, she just nixed, which I completely understand. Like, it's a children's story for the most part. But I mentioned Ron Howard. I mentioned Jim Carrey as the Grinch, but this is another star-studded production. We also get the narration by Anthony Hopkins. Hello, Clarice. We get Taylor Momsen as Cindy Lou Who, Jeffrey Tambor, Christine Baranski, Bill Irwin, and Molly Shannon in supporting roles. Honestly, Max the dog has been and will always be my favorite character. It reaffirms what we know and speaks so much to dogs. They really love unconditionally. A dog even loves the Grinch.
Did you know that Max the dog was played by a girl?
No.
A girl dog. Girl power. Her name is Kelly.
Oh, she's so cute.
She's the man. Also, I read that they were going to make the dog CGI and they decided against it, which I'm so glad they did not go the CGI route, because Max-Kelly's facial expressions were so golden.
So gold, so precious, so golden. I'm so glad too. Academy Award for Kelly the dog. But Taylor Momsen, who I mentioned as Cindy Lou Who, was only 7 years old during this movie, and it was really her first exposure to the spotlight prior to, you know, landing the Jenny Humphrey role in Gossip Girl and fronting her band, The Pretty Reckless. She recently said on her TV brother, Penn Badgley's podcast, quote, "First of all, the Grinch changed my life in a multitude of ways. One of them being, I was made fun of relentlessly. Every time I would start a new school or go somewhere else, I don't even think the kids knew my name. I was just Grinch Girl," end quote. In 2020, she said one of her favorite moments from the set was the chance to work with Jim Carrey. Quote, "I just remember him being so kind, so concerned, but so methodical with what he was doing. Even at that young age, I remember watching him and going, I'm watching an artist at work right now," end quote. And I just love that even though she may have had some kids that were jealous of her and made fun of her, she had a really positive experience on set, it sounds like. And I don't know if all child actors can say that.
It is kind of shitty that she got bullied because, like,
just jealous, Dave.
Right. Because, I mean, she's in a movie with freaking Jim Carrey.
Yeah.
Who is like
a blockbuster smash.
Yeah. Oh, that makes me so sad for her. But I'm glad she had a great experience. I also read that this movie was like her gateway to becoming a singer. She said that the experience of recording "Where Are You, Christmas?" made her fall in love with singing. So, like, who knows where she'd be?
This movie is so impactful. But the actors and extras who played the Whos in Whoville had to go to Who school to learn the ways that Whos behave and act through choreography. So, like, the Whos were very choreographed in this movie, and that makes sense. The stunt coordinator brought in trained acrobats and circus performers from Cirque du Soleil to make up the Who's in Whoville because their enthusiasm was so great and they were always willing to try something new. Speaking of extras, the Grinch had the most extras in full costume and heavy makeup in over 60 years, taking the title from The Wizard of Oz. And now that I do think about it, there are a ton of people just in these costumes and with all this makeup on.
Yeah, like no one can look normal. Even the extras have to have the nose.
It was a lot of work and it was a lot of trial and tribulations, especially for our lead, Jim Carrey. Let's talk about that a little bit. So the makeup and the costumes in this movie were award-winning and ahead of their time. The Grinch suit was obviously one of the main costumes in this movie. The suit was covered in yak hair that was dyed green and sewed onto a spandex suit that Jim would wear. Application of his makeup, that took up to 2.5 hours to put on him every single day. And Jim regularly and repeatedly described the costume and makeup like he was being buried alive. And after one session, he was so frustrated and sick of being in this costume all day, he kicked a hole in the wall of his trailer. And Jim's makeup artist, Kazu Hiro, sorry if I said that wrong, but he recounted that, quote, on set, Jim was really mean to everybody. And at the beginning of the production, they couldn't finish. After 2 weeks, we could only finish 3 days worth of shooting schedule because suddenly he, Jim, would just disappear. And when he came back, everything was ripped apart. So I think he's talking about his costume and his makeup. Hiro said they couldn't shoot anything. And Hiro actually left the production until Ron Howard had a discussion with Jim on how important Hiro was to the project. Jim agreed to keep his anger and frustration in check, and they actually brought in a consultant to train Jim on methods of enduring torture. And as a result, Hiro was able to feel comfortable returning to the set and resuming his role of a makeup artist. And in total, Jim spent 92 days in the Grinch makeup and seemingly became adept at remaining calm during its application and wearing it all day.
So I read that it wasn't just like any consultant that taught him about like how to withstand torture, that it was like someone from the CIA.
Yeah, it was someone they bring in for the CIA. So like the pro of the pro.
That's crazy. Also, 92 days is so long. That's like 3 whole months. I also heard that his preferred method of like keeping himself calm was chain smoking.
Oh my God.
But that the yak hair was flammable, so he needed to use like a special cigarette holder to like keep the flame away from it. I also read that Hiro, he was retired when they made the movie, so that they had to drag him out of retirement. And then Jim was so mean to him, he quit. And then Jim had to convince him to come back after having to convince him to come out of retirement in the first place. Can you imagine like being on the beach, enjoying your life, coming out of retirement for a movie that is like, you're pretty sure you're going to get an Oscar for it, and then just getting yelled at by Jim Carrey.
Having like a perpetual meltdown. No, I know. I actually read, to boost Jim's morale, to cheer him up, Ron Howard got dressed in the Grinch garb to attempt to, I guess, empathize with Jim, make him laugh a little bit. He got all Grinched up himself one day, but that's just one day compared to the 92 days.
And I read that too. Yeah, that he had to wake up at like 3 a.m. one morning to get the whole routine done because it took hours and hours. And he spent like the day directing in the costume. I read that Jim wasn't happy about it because he came on set and sees another Grinch all done up. And he apparently got really angry because he thought Howard was a stunt double who, quote, looked nothing like him. But then when someone was like, no, dude, like it's Ron, he's trying to make like a peace offering and like empathize with you about what you're going through. He's trying to do it too, so he can like better understand your plight in your Grinch suit. He was like, more understanding, Jim was. So, but I do think it went a long way with Jim that the director was willing to like take that step.
Ron was really trying. He also brought acting legend Don Knotts to the set from the Andy Griffith Show in an attempt to cheer Jim up because he knew that Jim was a huge fan of Don Knotts' work. I feel like Ron was really trying to make Jim feel better, but I think Jim really went through a hard time during this movie, and I'm not judging. I can only imagine how difficult that might have been. And then also kind of trying to be in character with this like Grinchy person. You know, so many of these actors are at least somewhat method. Like he's going to be probably acting grouchy in general anyways. And then adding just like all this physical discomfort as well. Like, I can only imagine. In fact, the Whoville set was built mostly on the backlot of Universal Studios behind the Bates Motel. And Jim apparently ran out in full costume and fake knife one day to scare the tourists. I wonder if that was just him being like, ah, like I'm happy. And they had no idea it was him. But I mean, he was seemingly really, really going through it.
Yeah, he was definitely going through it. I remember hearing that the contact lenses were particularly really painful for him. So that for some scenes, he was like, I just can't do it. I can't stand it. So they had to digitally paste the yellow eyes onto him in some of the scenes. But I can't tell. I mean, now I'm going to rewatch it like and see if I might be able to tell the difference, but I don't think I will. Also, you mentioned the set. So I read that they almost made Whoville totally CGI, just like Max, but they decided to make it a mix of real and rendered, and to make the snow look more realistic, they used crushed marble.
Wow.
152,000 pounds of marble. So it wouldn't look like that cheap, flimsy shit that you see in like a Hallmark movie.
That's one way to make snow look expensive as hell. Use marble. Can
you imagine all of the countertops that we could have had?
Imagine. But the 2000 release initially received mixed reviews from critics, though Jim's performance and the makeup have received universal praise and obviously has gained a very strong cult following. The film spent 4 weeks as the number one film in the United States when it came out in 2000 and grossed $345.8 million worldwide, making it the sixth highest grossing film of 2000. At the time, it also became the second highest grossing holiday film of all time, just behind, you guessed it, Home Alone. However, both films were surpassed in 2018 by the third film adaptation of The Grinch story. This movie, unlike Home Alone that got snubbed, won the Academy Award for Best Makeup. Maybe it made it all worth it for Jim, you know, who knows?
Or for poor Hero,
yes,
who came out of retirement for this just to get yelled at.
I know, poor thing. I have so many favorite parts in this movie, but for me, probably my all-time is just the Grinch's one-liners and self-deprecating quips. For example, this is what I'm talking about.
4 o'clock, wallow in self-pity. 4:30, stare into the abyss. 5 o'clock, solve world hunger. Tell no one. 5:30, jazzercise. 6:30, dinner with me. I can't cancel that again. 7 o'clock, wrestle with my self-loathing. I'm booked.
Like, oh my God, this is just like, I love, again, like the self-deprecating kind of grumpy humor. It just
jazzercise.
Jazzercise.
I can't cancel that again. It was so fun. He made that line up, I heard.
He made, yeah, dinner with me.
Dinner with me, yeah.
Help me. I'm feeling.
Max! Help me! I'm feeling.
Hate, hate, hate. Double hate, loathe entirely.
Hate, 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 double hate, loathe entirely.
I also read that he improvised the table scene where he like rips the tablecloth off.
Oh.
He was originally supposed to mess everything up on the first go. But as we know in the movie, he rips the tablecloth off without messing up any of the table setting. Like all the plates and stuff are fine. So then he has to go back and mess it all up himself. So that was improvised, which is kind of cool. Yeah. Also, like, what a cool hidden talent. I've always wanted to try that.
One day,
not today, not with anything I own. I also personally really love Baby Grinch. I just think he's so cute. And I love his little voice and his little lisp. And he's like, oh, Martha. Oh, Quithmas.
Oh, Martha. Oh, Christmas.
It's just so cute.
Sweet.
You're right.
And I was thinking, like, with all this conversation with Jim not being able to stand the makeup and the process, like, how did the little 8-year-old actor who played him, like, handle all of that, I wonder?
I feel like I read about that. I think he had like a day or two in the costume. And so
not 92.
Yeah. Like I probably sucked, but the end was in sight.
Oh, when he gets bullied in that movie, that really breaks my heart. When he shows up with like the little blood spots, like on his beard, because he tried to shave. Oh,
I love this movie.
I love this movie. I know.
It is the best. Well, I have one more for you, Mary. The final movie I want to touch on is Love Actually. It came out in 2002, which I can't believe it. And 20 years after its release, it's back in theaters. And I'm not surprised because it's definitely become a Christmas classic and a cult favorite. No one really, I won't say no one liked it, but it didn't have as warm of a reception back when it came out as I feel like it has now. This is one of those movies that has like 10 different storylines and they all intersect in some way, come together at the end. And this is how the Wall Street Journal describes it. I thought it was very funny. Quote, one character has lost his wife, two get cheated on, another receives unwanted attention from the U.S. president, and still another has to put family obligation ahead of a romantic relationship. Ah, what says Christmas? Like a twisted plot line. That's a lot of ground to cover in one movie. Wouldn't you say so? Are you a fan of this one?
Yes, I haven't watched it as recently as I have the others, but my mom's a huge Colin Firth fan, so this was definitely on rotation back in the day.
Love that for you. I have some fun facts that you may know already, but according to BuzzFeed, here's some things that we may not know about Love Actually. I actually didn't know any of these, so they were all new to me. First of all, this cast, holy shit. Colin Firth, Hugh Grant, Emma Thompson, I mean, Alan Rickman.
Liam Neeson
and the little boy who was in Queen's Gambit. And I freaked out because I was like, how are you so old?
I know.
Anyways, Colin Firth and Hugh Grant storylines were supposed to be separate films. But the director wanted to make a movie about love as like the subject, not just one example of it. So that's why we have so many different examples of it. So Mr. Bean, speaking of a star-studded cast, makes a cameo. And he actually was sort of the reason why the airport scenes made it into the movie, because the director was traveling while filming Mr. Bean the movie. And he saw all of these reunions at airports. And he thought, wow, that is such an example of love. I also thought it was really interesting that none of the airport scenes are staged. Those are all real people coming home or visiting loved ones during the holiday season. When they were making the movie, they had to like rush these people with release forms after capturing these really authentic moments, which if you've ever had to ask people to sign release forms, it can be very stressful. So kudos to the producers. I have to say, this part makes me really emotional. Airports are just like an emotionally charged place for me personally. I don't know if that's weird, but like, especially when people have signs and stuff and they're welcoming people home. Atlanta and Denver also like specifically seem to have like so many people waiting for people. They have like a really cute like waiting area that people are always congregated at. And I always get really excited for the people who are being welcomed in, you know, such a grandiose way.
Yeah.
Like, what's more touching and effortful than going to the airport, parking your car, getting out, and then holding up a sign that you made? Like, that's a love language, like all on its own. Sorry for my airport rant, but I feel like if you want to make somebody feel loved this holiday season, like that's a gift in itself. Like, welcome them at the airport with a sign.
It's basically a free gesture.
A free gesture. I don't know. That scene just always gets me right in my feels. And it starts with the airport scene, ends with an airport scene. I love how they bookended it that way. So speaking of Mr. Bean, the infamous gift wrapping scene, you all know the one, when Alan Rickman's character, RIP by the way, is shopping for his mistress from his workplace while holiday shopping with his wife at the mall. Idiot. He tries to buy this heart necklace. And Mr. Bean, who works at the jewelry store, says, would you like this gift wrapped? And he takes forever to gift wrap the item. Understandably, Alan's character gets really nervous that his wife will discover him purchasing the item. And he's like, oh my God, what's next? You're going to put some chocolate buttons on it. Well, apparently, Mr. Bean was really dragging out the scene with 10-minute long takes. So Alan Rickman was genuinely annoyed by how long it was taking. So I just thought that was kind of funny because that's one of the more memorable scenes.
I love it.
So let's talk about the other iconic scene, the cards. You know, the one that the guy holds up because he's in love with his best friend's new wife. To me, you are perfect. Those cards. When she's like, it's carol singers. I love that line. Well, I always wonder who's writing
the props that we always see in movies like this, you know, like do actors really write the things out themselves? And like the close-ups in movies where they're writing in a diary or a letter or whatever, these are the minutiae that like keep me up at night. But luckily with this scene, we no longer have to guess because Andrew Lincoln, the actor, said he wrote those cards out himself. Don't you feel like his handwriting is like perfect for the role?
Yes.
Like, you know, when someone's handwriting like doesn't match them as a person, I feel like his handwriting matches him. Fun fact that no one will ever ask you if you know or not, but now you know. Next time you watch this movie, you can say, hey, Andrew, the guy actually wrote those with his own handwriting. Isn't that hilarious? So let's talk about some of our favorite parts. I can't get beyond the fact that in the Christmas nativity play that there's a Christmas lobster. And when Emma's character is like, there was more than one lobster at the birth of baby Jesus.
And I'm the lobster.
The lobster?
Yeah.
In the nativity play?
Yeah, first lobster.
There was more than one lobster present at the birth of Jesus.
Duh.
Or when everyone's calling the prime minister, you know, Natalie, she's the new girl in the prime minister's office. Everyone calls her chubby.
You know Natalie, who works here?
The chubby girl.
Which sounds like such an old relic from the early 2000s. Like no one would say that. And she's not overweight by any means, but I really like when he's like, ooh, would we call her chubby? Like it's an outdated thing, but I feel like he handled it very funny. Speaking of the prime minister, Hugh Grant, his dance scene. I mean, it's just so fun and joyful. Apparently, Hugh Grant didn't want to do it at all. He said it was 8 a.m. and he was sober. So it wasn't fun. But it was his idea to have his secretary walk in on him while he's dancing, which I just find really delightful.
I love that.
Finally, to wrap it up, my favorite scene and also a fun fact, one of my favorite lines from any Christmas movie ever is, I hate Uncle Jamie. So this is when Uncle Jamie, Colin Firth's character, goes home on Christmas Eve and he has all these presents for his nieces and nephews. It's a full house. And he realizes that he needs to go tell his housekeeper that he's in love with her and she's Portuguese and only speaks Portuguese. He's like, I'm sorry, but I have to go, as soon as he walks in the door. So all the little nieces and nephews are like, I hate Uncle Jamie. My sister and I just randomly say this to each other. I really don't want to teach my niece the word hate because I just don't think she should know what that means. But I really want to hear her say this in her little voice.
That'd be so,
so badly.
Cute.
I won't do it because I love her. But even funnier, the director Richard Curtis named Colin Firth's character Jamie because of this line. The director Richard, his real life brother's name is Jamie. And he just wanted to have all those kids say, I hate Uncle Jamie in a movie. Sibling love.
Oh, siblings. I need to go back and revisit this one because it's such a great movie. And thank you for jolting the memes with this one.
You can see it in theaters now. Well, Mare, this was fun. I really feel like I have relived a part of my childhood.
Yes, no kidding. Great movies. And thank you everybody so much for listening. We appreciate you. We hope you have an incredible Christmas. We are going to be off for the Christmas holiday. We won't have an episode out on the 25th, but we will have a fun episode for the new year, January 1st. So stay tuned for that. Have a wonderful rest of your holiday season. Be sure to subscribe. Give us 5 stars if you're feeling generous, or leave us a nice review. And we appreciate you.
Love you guys.
Bye.
Bye.